Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, the idea of getting up on stage may terrify most of us, but actor Jeffrey Tambor knew from a very young age that was exactly what he wanted to do. And as long as he can recall, he wanted to give people his autograph. Tambor is an acclaimed stage and screen actor. He got his first professional break at Seattle Repertory Theater and went on to a long career of notable roles. But in 2014, his portrayal of Maura Pfefferman on the Amazon series Transparent took him to a new level. Jeffrey Tambor is the author of Are You Anybody? A Memoir. He spoke with Seattle-based author and Salon TV critic Melanie McFarland at Town Hall Seattle on May 23rd. Jenny Cecil Moore recorded their conversation. Please note, this recording contains unedited language of an adult nature. We're presenting our broadcast version here. You'll find the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Here, Seattle Arts and Lectures' Rebecca Hoogs introduces the event.
If there were a column called Celebrities, they're just like Seattleites. But of course, there wouldn't be, that's ridiculous. There would be many pictures of one man, Jeffrey Tambor. He's pale, he likes the rain. He not only loves to read, he owns a freaking bookstore, people. His first gig was at the Seattle Rep. He lived on Queen Anne, where he baked a lot of poorly risen bread in his downtime. Jeffrey Tambor is indeed one of us. His bread may not have risen, but Jeffrey Tambor has, slowly, to become one of the best actors of his time, exactly by being one of us. Maybe you discovered him on Three's Company, or The Ropers, or Hill Street Blues, or Max Headroom. Maybe you joined the fan club when he played Hank Kingsley on The Larry Sanders Show. I joined the club after I'd had some minor stomach surgery and decided to recuperate by spending the weekend binging on this show I'd been hearing about, Arrested Development. That was a very bad idea. I couldn't stop laughing, even though it hurt so much. That exquisite dance between laughter and pain is what Tambor has done so well as Maura Pfefferman on Transparent, now headed into its fourth season. In the role, Tambor plays a transgender, divorced, Jewish parent of three. It's a wonderfully complicated role for which Tambor has won an Emmy and a Golden Globe. One of George Bluth, aka Tambor's signature lines from Arrested Development is, "No touching!" And yet, over his long career as an actor and now a writer, he has touched us. We have been moved, we have laughed, cried, yes, touching, yes. Thank you, Jeffrey. Please join me in giving Jeffrey a huge and unusually warm Seattle welcome to Jeffrey Tambor.
Hello, Jeffrey.
Hello. Is this a church?
In a sense, yes, it is.
Okay.
So let's talk about your time in Seattle. Let's start that way. You were in Seattle in 1977, right?
1977. Mm-hmm. I was at the Seattle Rep. I think it was my first. It was my first pro job. I'd been in repertory before, semi-pro, and I lived on Queen Anne Hill. And my rent was $125 a month. And it's got to be up to $200, $250 now.
That's
and no,
right.
I didn't go up there, but I loved it. And I think the people we rented from, it was my wife and I, my then wife and I, two cats, and all the tchotchkes you can imagine. And oh, I loved it. And I would walk down the hill to the Seattle Rep every day. And I'd never spent any time in the Pacific Northwest, and it's... And I'm from San Francisco, so I loved the rain. It did. There was a smattering of dust of snow one day, and I remember that. I've never seen anything quite like that. The city just went, no, no, we don't do snow. and it just stopped. But I loved it, and I used to go to Pike Street Market and get my, well, I told you all that. I just, I love the city, I love the people, it's great.
I wanted to ask you about the bread a little bit. She mentioned the bread in the beginning.
Yeah, what's with the bread?
I have never had problems getting my bread to rise here. So
I had problems.
What do you think it was?
Well, somebody actually told me. That's why. Someone said, the reason your bread is not rising, I guess maybe they're trying not to hurt my feelings. But they said, because is there something with the sea level here? Are we high, low? What are we? That's hysterical. I can't understand one word you're saying. Is it high? It's low, so that's the reason. So my bread wouldn't rise. It sounds like the second book. My bread wouldn't rise, anyhow.
But let's talk about this book, You Anybody?
Yes.
So if you guys have not read this, you really should. It's one of the funniest things I've read in a while. It's a very quick read as well. And one thing that I really love about it is that it's intensely personal. But at the same time, it also tells you a lot about a life in entertainment. But also, let's talk about the title. So what does Are You Anybody exactly mean?
It's a literal allusion. I was doing Broadway. I was an understudy, but I had three lines in the play. I actually had one line that I said three times as a servant to George C. Scott. Remember George C.? In Sly Fox, directed by Arthur Penn. And the line was, "You look wonderful, sir." I walked out of the stage door and I had my faux cashmere jacket on, $300 from Bloomingdale's, my hat, my scarf, you know. And there was it was pre-selfie, and it was, it was just autographs and pre-sell and all that. And there was this legendary character who went from theater to theater to theater, and he would get autographs from people either coming out of the theater or people who had gone to the theater that night. And he looked at me as I came out, face to face, nose to nose, and he went, "Are you anybody?" And I looked at him back and blink, and I went, "No." And I'll never forget that feeling because I went, "I am nobody." Well, cashmere jacket or no. So that's sort of my entrance to that. But this is not about a book about getting an autograph, although that was my fondest wish as a young kid. But it's about becoming, I guess, Jeffrey, and becoming a father, and becoming a teacher, and becoming an actor, and becoming a citizen, and the trials and tribulations. And I tried to write it like I talk, and no other pretensions other than that. Just everybody needs a laugh, a little cry, and a little lesson, and that's what I tried to do.
Mm-hmm. And this is also a book really inspired and written to your children, right?
To my children, who have absolutely no idea what Daddy does for a living. I have a daughter in her late 30s. She's 41. And she hates when I do that, but she's not here. And then we skip a little bit, and we have 12, Gabriel, 10, Evie, and then 2 7s, Hugo and Eli. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. And I would like them to know at the end of the day, and I mean that literally, at the end of the day, why Daddy was walking around mumbling the way he did. And always, my daughter Evie said, I can always tell, she's 10 years old, she says, I can always tell when Daddy's working on a role, because he stares into the distance. In other words, you're a writer. It's not a 9-to-5. It's 24/7. You know, who knows when inspiration hits and things like that. And I would like them to know that a little bit. Right now, they think I eat lunch for a living. Because they come to the set and we have lunch. And they think that's my W-2 form. Evie actually said one day, and you have to understand, on one visitation, they'll see Maura, or they'll see Oscar Bluth, or I'm now the voice of a burrito, for God's sakes, on TV. Any character that has a low voice on TV, they go, is that you? So I'd like them to know a little bit about what I went through and why I am the daddy I am. I would like them to know that and give them a little lift. And at the end of the day, I would like to know I am successful because of mommy and they, because they are my teachers. Literally, they are my instructors. Because at 70, you lose the book a little bit. And they've become the book. They teach me and they inspire me. And they are, as I say in the book, they're outrageous. They're uproarious. Their attitude is, they're not afraid. They have heart. They have humor, which you can lose. Mm-hmm. You can lose humor. And they inspire me every day. So I would like them to know that.
Yeah, there are a lot of great stories in this book, and one of the things that's really wonderful about the format is that it's a life told in essay form. It captures a lot of different...
I was born in Buffalo on a cold, wintry night.
So talk a little bit about...
Buffalo?
What was your decision? Yeah, talk a little bit about Buffalo.
talk about Buffalo. Go ahead.
But what about that? When we spoke yesterday, you had mentioned that you actually wanted to write it. You wanted to achieve two things. Mm-hmm. You wanted to have it sound like your voice, which it does.
Right.
If you watch enough of Jeffrey's work, you will hear him reading to you as you were reading this, which is significant that to capture voice in writing. But the second thing is you made a deliberate choice to really render this in the format of essays. Mm-hmm. So they're really... almost, they're attached but separate glimpses into your life. So can you talk a little bit about that?
I just took a shot at, I go around the country, I'm with a, may I be shameless, APB speaking group, and I go around to universities and I talk. I love it, it's something that I love. You don't make a fortune doing it and it's hard. But I love talking to people at the colleges. And I tell stories about my life because the way I was taught and the way I teach is personal, and the best directors ever are ones that are personal in their work, and you start talking about your life. So I talk about my kids, I talk about mom and dad, I talk about my sobriety, I talk about everything, and I'm funny, and I'm sad, and these are stories, and someone finally just said, I went to South by Southwest for about 10, 12 years, and I would work in a workshop, and I loved doing that. And someone finally just said, you need to put this in a book. And I kind of went, ha, hoo, ha, because I honor writers so much that I went, I don't know if we need another celeb book, you know, and I don't say that lightly, I just, now I think I have something to say. And I read a book by Frank Langella, and I think we talked about it, and it's a perfect book. It's just all like slants on a life, and then you put that together and you get a life, rather than I met this person and I met this person and I was in that and then I co-starred in that, and it's not that. It's a life lived, and I like that.
Do you mind reading one of my favorite chapters?
Sure.
He has this great chapter. It's called The Red Bow Tie. And I'll have a question for you all afterwards. So take it away.
What did you say?
I said, take it away.
Oh, I thought you said, take your time. And I went, I'll do what I want. Thank you. Now take your time. Don't rush. Wouldn't it be funny if you just started directing me louder, louder? I told you it would be like this. Red Bow Tie. I grew up in San Francisco, a magical place. Our first house was on 31st Street, which meant we were 31 blocks and change from the Pacific Ocean. It was foggy every morning, clear or overcast, and 60 degrees every afternoon, and the fog rolled back in on the dot at 5 p.m. The fog was moody, lovely, and taught me to love inclement weather. That's why Los Angeles and I never got along. It's sunny all the time. I am the Jewish son of Russian-Hungarian parents. I can't have sunny all the time. My maternal grandparents, Yosef and Gertrude Salzberg, lived nearby, and my grandmother would sometimes babysit for me when my parents were away. She would bring her homemade pickles, dill, half-sour, garlic. She brought matzah and gefilte fish and herring. One time, she brought this wonderful cocoa, and she put a pot of milk on the stove. She spooned in the cocoa and a little sugar and stirred and stirred and stirred. When it was ready, she handed me a mug of it. Bliss. That same weekend, she brought me a gift, a red bow tie. To this day, I have absolutely no idea why. It was big and shiny, and I loved it. My parents used to take me out to dinner with them, and we'd all get dressed up, me in my charcoal suit and white shirt and that big, beautiful red bow tie. We would eat at Joe's of Westlake and order the legendary Joe's special, scrambled eggs, ground meat, and spinach. But before we ate, my parents liked to have a drink at the bar in the lounge. I wasn't allowed to sit at the bar, so I would sit at a table by myself near the piano player, sipping my Shirley Temple. I loved to watch people, study their mannerisms and their gestures. It was as good as reading a book, a dark book with piano music and cigarette smoke. My parents couldn't get over the fact that I never complained that we didn't eat until 9 p.m. People would come up to me and say, "Hello, little boy. What a beautiful bow tie." And get this, they would give me money. Not pennies, not quarters, not half dollars. They gave me dollar bills. Some sat down to talk to me and tell me their stories. I became used to the smell of alcohol on their breath. One doctor sat down with me and told me about a patient he had lost that day. He had a martini with two olives in his hand and tears in his eyes. I couldn't get over all the attention, the stories, the sharing. I knew it wasn't because of me, it was because of it. The bow tie had magical power. This red, glittery thing made me feel confident and wise. I felt connected. I felt powerful. I felt helpful. I felt safe. I took that feeling with me when I walked to school or around my neighborhood. I felt it when my mom got me a new pair of kids, and I would run around the neighborhood feeling like I was the fastest creature on earth. I remember thinking, this is the fastest I will ever be. Ever. I even woke my parents up early one morning to tell them just that. They were unimpressed. I used to go to the soapbox derby races with my brother and my father every weekend. They were held outside the Harding Park golf course, not far from our house. My brother and I would watch the kids get in their go-karts at the top of the hill, and I was able to tell which one would win just by how the driver sat in the car. During each and every race, I would guess the winner, and I got it right every time. People started to place bets based on my guesses. Which one, son? People were making money on my say-so, including my dad and brother. I was invincible. And then one night when I was about 8 years old, I was getting dressed in my little suit to go to Joseph Westlake, and I could not find my red bow tie. I searched and searched, but no red bow tie. I went to my mother to see if she knew where it was. "Come on, Jeffrey. We're late, but I can't find my red bow tie." "What red bow tie?" "My red bow tie, the one Grandma gave me." "Grandma never gave you..." "I wear a red bow tie. I always wear a red bow tie." "There is no red bow tie. You never had a red bow tie." I was speechless. "You have a small blue bow tie. That's the only one you have. Now go put it on and hurry." I went to my room, I got the little blue bow tie, and we went to Joe's. I sat with my Shirley Temple near the piano player as usual, but nobody talked to me. No one approached. Nobody gave me money. Nobody sat down and told me their story. Even the piano player was silent. I began to feel an unfamiliar sensation in the middle of my chest. Fear? My connection to the world was gone. My red bow tie was gone. Not only gone, it may never have existed. And now when we went to the soapbox derby, I was clueless about who would win. And when I walked around the neighborhood, I was afraid. I would spend the rest of my life looking for that red bow tie, trying to connect to that feeling it gave me, that access, that magic. I sometimes struggle to find it, and on occasion I do, and in the most unexpected places, on stage, on a set, in a grocery store, behind the wheel of a car in a strange town, in a book, as a sidekick, as twin brothers, and to no one's surprise more than mine, as a woman.
Thank you.
I'm sure you noticed it, but I've read that twice now in public, and the same thing happens. I always go right to that emotion. And the first time I read it was a week ago last at the 92nd Y, and I went, oh my God, I'm going to start crying. As soon as I brought it up, and so what I think is remarkable is not the writing, but you as a writer must know this. I went, as I was reading it last week, I went, oh my God, this is true. This really is true. Not factually, but you know, to me. And I thought that was, I felt that again. We all have that. I mean, we all have the red bow tie, you know, and that's what I'm glad and of course, since the publication of the book, I have received so many red bow ties. I mean, the closet is full.
What are you going to do with all of them?
Wear the red bow tie and go to a bar and start talking.
So here's my question for the audience, mm-hmm. really quickly. How many of you think that the red bow tie is real? That's a great answer. How many of you think that it's a metaphor? Interesting. So what's the actual answer, Jeffrey? Is the red bow tie real?
You mean the second people think I'm lying? I came all the way to Seattle to get that attitude? We think you're not telling the truth. It's real. It's real, and it's a metaphor. And these are the lessons that you put in your back pocket, you know? I don't know about the blue red. I don't know about the blue. I do know that that little switcheroo happened where that conversation with good old Ma Mayor happened, where she said there was no tie. And that's where you went, was there a, you know? But it was really magical. People gave me money. I don't get it. I mean, it became a losing, you know, capitalist proposition after that. No. I think it has to do with the dreams, naivete. I think as kids, we know things and we can pick off things and then something happens. Mm-hmm. I'm very interested in that proposition when we lose the magic and then you gain it back again. Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating subject. And I see it in my kids all the time. They're savants, they get it, they just get it. They can read me, they can read every nuance. You know, and it's wonderful. It's a wonderful lesson. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're talking a little bit about.
Can I say one more thing?
This is your show.
Oh, that's right. I can say anything I want.
I can just sit here and nod.
I think what's interesting about that is when you took away the red bow tie, that feeling of fear. Because I remember that going, what the hell is that? What is that feeling of I'm afraid to leave the block? What was that all about?
And you have a name for that fear, don't you?
Mrs. Cohen.
Yes. Old Mrs. Cohen.
Old Mrs. Cohen. Yeah. Mrs. Cohen was the one who lived in, she said Mrs. Cohen lived in the back. And you don't talk to Mrs. Cohen. And you say, Mrs. Cohen, do you see how Trump went to Israel? And she goes, see, how can I see? I live in the back. And that's the story. So I call her Mrs. Cohen, and you never talk to Mrs. Cohen.
When we were speaking earlier, we spoke yesterday, and mm-hmm. one of the things that you had mentioned was that there's a difference between an actor's nerves and a writer's nerves.
Right.
The actor's nerves, of course, you've spent many decades getting used to. But what is the difference with the writer's nerves?
In acting, the character is stuck with you and you're stuck with the character, and you can express yourself through the character. But when you start talking about a red bow tie and talking about your family life, or you're talking about your sobriety, or you're talking about things or that happened to you in repertory or mishaps and everything like that, I don't know, you think almost, you know, I had trouble. Tammy from Crown is here tonight, and we were talking about it, that I couldn't hand over the book. Because I kept saying, oh, I need another pass. And I know what it was all about. The book was ready, but I was afraid to let it go. In a way, I thought I was going to get in trouble.
Then you are truly a writer, because I do that every day and drives my editors crazy.
Do you think you're going to get in trouble?
Yeah,
oh, and you do get in trouble.
Oh, all the time.
Yeah. Well, I think I was going to go, you know, you don't, there were things that happen in our family. We have every family has it around the Thanksgiving table where you have the family secret and you have the family thing and you share that. And what's a memoir for? What are you going to do? Tell somebody else's story? So I decided to tell a little bit. It's a good thing I handed it in because I started to move back a little bit. But yeah, and those nerves and then even talking about it. Is very hard on me. And then I don't even know how to sign a book. I mean, I don't even know what to say. So that's all very wonderfully nervous mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you put in a book when you sign it? And what's your general autograph? You practiced your autograph as a kid, so how's it turned out?
I used to go downstairs when we lived in San Francisco, and I would practice. Well, I would do a show. I would do The Tonight Show. And I would have a chair and a chair and a desk, and I would interview myself. My poor parents upstairs. And I had a lisp, so I would interview myself like this, and of course I would answer myself like this. And for some reason I would get up and go to the other chair. There was no one watching. But then I would also do the laughter, the audience laughter. And my laughter was very much my grandma used to laugh like this. So I would laugh like my grandma. I would go. And my parents were right upstairs in the kitchen. I'm surprised they didn't arrange an exorcism. Because I was just, I don't know. And then I would sign autographs down there. Best wishes, Jeffrey Tambor. Good luck on the playground today, Jeffrey Tambor. Have a great time that's all I wanted to do is sign an autograph. And I would give them out in school. Mrs. Fisher would say, what are you doing? Best wishes, good luck today. Have fun on the reading assignment, Jeffrey Tambor. The things we do.
Do you get more requests for autograph for people who recognize you as George Bluth? George and Oscar Bluth, Maura Pfefferman, or, for instance, your characters from, like, Hellboy. Do you have Hellboy fans coming up and saying, hey? Or Hank Kingsley?
Things that are shouted out of a window are, hey now, there's always money in the banana stand. And now the new and favorite of mine is, yes, queen, which is transparent. Yesterday in the elevator coming down to meet Tammy, I just want to tell you how famous I am. The guy went, really loved you on Everybody Loves Raymond. I said, that's not me. And they went, oh, it is you. I went, it's not me, and I went, oh God, 20 floors of this. and they wouldn't get off of it. That's the thing. And it's the first time that's happened. First time. That's Peter Boyle.
So what do you do in those situations? Do you just say, okay, thank you, or?
I was trained by the great Henry Winkler. And Henry Winkler is the nicest person in the world.
He is.
Right? You've met him. And you always kind of look. I always try to say, "What? He's going to crack. He's not that nice." But he is. And he said, it's their first time. And it's your 500th or 499th or whatever, and be graceful. And it's right. So I always say, I once said no, and it was in an elevator, and actually a bad thing had happened to me. I just had a terrible, terrible piece of news given to me, and I said, "Oh, it's not a good time right now." And the guy went off on me. "Oh, so you're just too important." And again, I was in an elevator. Going up, and I went, and I learned my lesson. You always try to be nice. My kids don't like it too much, so I always try to be cool, or I'll have them join the picture and everything like that. But people are kind, I think. In New York, people, they don't care. So I mean, they just yeah.
What's been your greatest revelation in terms of what you've discovered about your fans or how people see your career after, and when you're interacting with people?
Are you saying my greatest revelation? What are you saying?
What's been your greatest revelation in terms of how people have seen you and how people have seen you through movies and television as you've kind of gone around?
Well, the biggest revelation I've ever had was all I wanted to do was give that autograph. And the first time I gave an autograph, I watched it, what he did with it. He took the autograph and he put it in his pocket, and I went, and there was Peggy Lee singing, "Is That All There Is?" I went, "Oh, yeah." But, and this is going to sound glib, and I don't mean it to sound glib, so I hope I say it right, but I feel sorry for you people getting my, and this is a good side, by the way. We were coming back from a party, my wife and I, and she said, "What's wrong? What's going on?" I went, "I wish somebody had told me." And she said, "What do you mean?" I said, "It's just a party. You know, I always thought it was like a ball, you know, like Cinderella or something like that. And it's just a party." And I wish I had known that, but I guess you get that with age. And the real party, and this is really the real reason for my book. The real red carpet for me is I have the two twin boys, Hugo and Eli, especially Eli. When I'm sitting there and I'm reading, they have a way, their seven-year-old way of just getting on me and just... getting right there on me and just being there. They want nothing else to just be there on my lap. They're not watching TV, we're not doing anything, just being there. And I went, "Oh, well, that's the red carpet." But it takes a little while to get that, because you can feel their warmth and their back on you, and you go, "That's as good as that gets." But, and there's just no way, to tell a young actor that who's just concerned about the billing or an "and" in front of your name and all that nonsense. Mm-hmm. So that's the biggest revelation to me, that that the marquee has finally realigned to its proper billing. And it's not Jeffrey Tambor, bup, 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 it's "and Jeffrey Tambor." And that's the big lesson. That's what I try to tell people. You know, save your money. I always say save your money, which was said to me by David Goldberg. Is it David Goldberg who did Family Ties? Is that right? Is it? What? I got the first name right? David? And he said, "Save your money." And I remember going, "Save your money." He was such a good guy. And I always say that to people, save your money, and remember your family, and don't cut there. But the reason I say save your money is because I think the power to say no is one of the most powerful things. We talked about it the other day. It is one of the most powerful tools in a life that you go, "No, thank you." It is so powerful, and you can't do that if you're worried about rent, car, whatever. And so I always tell my acting students, I've been a teacher for almost 50 years, I tell them, keep it low so you can say no. And we talked about, you know, transparent.
Mm-hmm. And that was, your saying no actually got you that role, you said.
It was very interesting. Maura came along, and as God being the ironist that he, she is, I saw the role on page 8, and I said, I'm in. And I just kept shouting it to anybody who would listen to me. Poor Jill Soloway, the great Jill Soloway, when we met the next day, I just kept saying, I'm in. And she would say another sentence. I said, I'm in, I'm in, I'm in, I'm in. I knew it was landmark. I knew it. I knew it was the property and the role of a lifetime. And I ran for it. At the very same time, I was offered a series on network TV, or as my mom and dad used to say, 2, 4, or 7. I would say, hey, I'm on MASH, and they say, what number? And I'd say 2, and they went, oh, 2, we get 2, 2 is good. Don't do 7, because that's kind of wavy. Don't do anything on 7. So I remember one of the agents that I had then said, you should do this and that. And I remember going, and I went, no, thank you. It caused a lot of trouble. It caused a little bit of a ruckus. And then I remember, this is interesting. I just remembered this. The producer got really angry at my then agent, and I got on to him. I said, leave her alone. I made that decision. I did that. And he actually backed me up and said, he actually affirmed what I was doing. He was very brave. And you have to figure out, here we are on Amazon TV. It's streaming. It's a baby studio. It's Maura Pfefferman, who is transitioning from a parent. You know that I did not get this. This is how intelligent I am. Do you know that I did not get the irony of the title?
I mean, I
about 4 weeks in, I went,
that.
Oh my God. I said it right in front of Jill. I think she thought I was fooling around. I went, oh my. I thought it was about being transparent. Anyhow, I remember other actors saying, what are you doing? What are you doing? I remember a friend of mine saying, you know, who had trouble with the subject matter. And he and I are still a little dicey about this, you know, but man, you got to follow your nose. You know, that's what my kids have taught me. And that's what I'm trying to do in that book. You follow that nose. Here's the thing. I found out that a dream is not something that go, oh, I can't wait. Oh, a dream is one that you go, oh, boy, I have to get up for this. This one is going to cost. A dream is worthless if it doesn't cost and is likely to disappoint people. Right? And that's,
amen.
That's yeah, and that's what I... Yeah. And luckily, I have a great wife who is just... I do this exercise. Take your hand and put your hand, other hand, underneath, just gently, all right? Now, just let it rest there, all right? That's called support. And the reason I do that is because that's all it is. But you have to have people around. The revelation that I have is to do a dream or to do the Mauras or whatever those things that are those, or that draft that you go, you know, you have to have a support system around you that allows you to do that. That's what you have to build. And that's what I try to write about in the book, because I've been around so many actors who've stopped. Most of the actors that I've taught over the years have stopped. And I've had some actors that are 20 times more talented than I. And I'm curious as to why people stop. That's sort of what the book is about, Are You Anybody? Because I don't know how I got here, except you know, that, as you say, that fire in the belly. Am I making any sense?
You're making complete sense, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I know that some folks have some questions, so if you have a question, just write it down on a card and get it to your usher.
That's
and
hysterical.
I'll be happy to read them
to your
for
usher.
You. Yes. And while we're waiting for the ushers to get those cards, I'm going to ask you about another favorite chapter of mine that actually happens to share the name of my motto, which is fuck 'em.
Fuck 'em. I love fuck 'em. It's not fuck you.
Nope.
It's not fuck it. It's called fuck 'em.
Fuck 'em.
Fuck 'em.
It's a great chapter.
And it's an attitude that I was taught. I went to a Greek restaurant called the Great Greek in Los Angeles, and I walked in and I thought I was something. I said, I'd like a nice table, and the guy gave me a table, the maitre d' gave me a table very near the kitchen, and I went, what the heck's that about? So I went in the next night and I said to the maitre d', I would like the worst table you have, and I would like to wait as inordinately long as possible. And this little smile came across his face, and he gave me the head table and the best table in the restaurant. And I went, I sat there, and then mid-meal, I got up and I went over to the front of the restaurant, and I tapped him and I said, I think I know what just happened, and I just want to thank you very, very much. And I'm sorry for my attitude the previous night. And he said, fuck 'em. And here's my take on it. And we talked about this the other day. It's an attitude that at the end of the day, if you want to fire me, but I'm going to give you my best. But I'm not going to be afraid of you firing me. And I'm not going to be afraid of you disliking me. And as we talked about, you know, it's not me. I'm way above my talent level, but this is what Jackson Pollock did when he went, fuck him. I'm just not going to play the realistic game. I'm not going to give you a portrait. I'm going to give you this splattering. I actually stood in his studio, in Jackson Pollock's studio, and saw that studio, and saw that on the floor, and I went, well, that's fuck 'em. And this is what we were talking about Tintoretto.
Yes.
Tintoretto took the Madonna and the baby Jesus, and rather than center in the Renaissance, he put it off center. And it created quite a furor. He was almost excommunicated. But that's fuck 'em. He's saying, here's the baby Jesus, fuck 'em. And it's an important attitude that has backfired on me many times. I remember the Coen brothers audition that I went to for that wonderful film, and I was up for the rabbi. Oh, God. The rabbi. First of all, I drove in, and they said at the gate at Fox Studios, or maybe, I don't know if it was, it was Sony, and I they said, you don't have a drive on. I went, oh, I, and they said, you have to park in the parking lot. So I drove in, and then I made a left turn, and I went all the way to the bungalow. And I took, this is fuck 'em, I took the orange cone out of the parking lot. Oh, you know where this is going, right? I took the orange cone that was reserved for somebody, and I took that parking space for my audition. You scared the hell out of me. My God. This just in, Jeffrey Tambor died this evening in Seattle. And so I went in, and there were the Coen brothers and the casting director, who was a little late and came in. She was very, you know, flurried and just kind of like, oh, what's going on? And there was a reason for that. you got it. And the Coen brothers, one of them, Ethan or Joel, said, what part do you want to read, the rabbi or the lawyer? And I said, I'll read the rabbi. The lawyer, you can do better. There was a look that transpired between these two genius directors. Well, I don't think anyone has ever said that to him. And then, in back of them, the casting director went like that. And I read the, and then as I was reading, I saw her put two and two together and saying, that mother is in my parking space. So, and as you can see, my fuck-em attitude, I've yet to appear in a Joel and Ethan Coen film. So easy on that advice. No, it's a good way to lead your life. What are the questions?
All right, here's a great one. What do you like or admire most or least about Maura Pfefferman?
I love Maura. I don't think there's anything that I dislike about her. I like that she's... When I first met Maura Pfefferman, it was room 609 in the Fairmont Hotel. Zachary Drucker and Reese Ernst, my trans teachers, made me up for the first time, Gesundheit. And I remember looking up and seeing her, and she averted her eyes, and then she looked and she smiled, and then averted her eyes. She was very shy, and she was afraid that she wasn't pretty, and I think she was pretty. And we've become very good friends. She's smarter than I, more intelligent than I, has a better sense of humor than I, has better word choice than I, and has affected me deeply, and I'm following her. She is the life lesson that I've been looking for. Now, here's the very interesting thing. My mother was not warm and fuzzy. She was tough. Things were tough in the Tambor household. You read about it in the book. The corridors were alive. And it was tough. And Mom and I were desperate, desperate enemies. Maura has this gesture. As I was watching dailies one day, I went, that's my mother's gesture. My mother used to sit at the table like that. And I went, this is why God made a circle. This is why it comes all the way around. So that's the lesson that I get. There's nothing she's petty. She's jealous. She's scared. Man, she's lonely. She can't relate. She doesn't know how to make up yet. She doesn't know how to, when she goes to the LGBTQ center, she doesn't really quite belong because she's of an age. She doesn't quite know if that dress works or not, if her hair works or not. I told you about, maybe I didn't tell you, I went on a trial, they were an experiment, and we went out, I said, let's take her shopping. So we dressed up and I put on my, you know, I thought Maura, when she would go shopping, would dress up. So I dressed up. Anyway, I'm in this market in North Hollywood and I'm going up and down the aisles and I stopped in one aisle and I looked and there was a guy looking at me. He stopped and he looked at me. And that smile on that guy's face was so ugly. Now, he either thought, one, that's Jeffrey Tambor. And it could be, but I think not, because my makeup was really good. But I think he thought that person is trans, and I'm having trouble with that. And I got, as they say, clocked. And it was so ugly, and it so threw me. And I remember saying, don't ever forget this. Don't ever forget it. And then I recovered, and we went outside, and Zachary's a great teacher. She goes, we're going to go outside and eat. And I went, oh, no. And so we went outside, and she goes, all the tables were taken, and she goes, go sit over there. And there was a gentleman sitting there, And he was on his phone. And I said, she goes, sit. So we sat there, and the guy was looking up, and he looked at Zachary, and he looked at me. And Zachary's beautiful. And we were sitting there, and I was eating, and the guy got through with his messaging, and he looked up, and he looked at me, and he went, have a good day, ladies. And when he left, we high-fived, like it was a, as if we were so, so it was a great learning experience. So Maura's leading me and teaching me as we go. And there's not a day that goes by that I don't have that tap, tap, tap of nervosity and do it right. Because lives are at stake. And I'm not speaking metaphorically, I'm talking literally. And there's not a week that goes by that where someone doesn't say something just beautiful or talks about their, people come up to me on the street and say things about their kids or their family or just talk to me about the Pfeffermans. And then there's the odd tweet that says you should be ashamed of yourself. So the revolution is here, it's happening. But I will tell you that Evie went to the set, my 10-year-old, and my wife and I went, oh gosh, this is gonna be interesting. Well, Daddy's playing this, Daddy looks like, and Evie interrupted us, and she wasn't 10, she was 9. And she said, hey guys, I understand, I get it. Daddy's playing a character who's more comfortable being a woman. From the mouth of babes.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Jeffrey Tambor is the author of Are You Anybody? A Memoir. He spoke with Seattle-based author and Salon TV critic Melanie McFarland at Town Hall Seattle on May 23rd. Thank you again to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. Tune in again soon.